No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in at 888-627-6008 if you have a question, or you can Skype your questions to BBS Radio. And tonight we have a great guest, former Attorney General for the District of Columbia, Irv Nathan, who was appointed in 2011, in his role as Attorney General. He supervised civil litigation and appeals on behalf of the city, as well as juvenile and misdemeanor prosecutions. He's also, prior to becoming Attorney General, he served as General Counsel in the United States House of Representatives. He also served as Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General at the U.S. Department of Justice and Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Enforcement in the Criminal Division, Senior Counsel for the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee, and Special Minority Counsel for the Senate Intelligence Committee. For more than 30 years, Irv has practiced law with Arnold and Porter, one of the most respected law firms in the city. So thank you so much for being on the show tonight, Irv, it's great to have you. And let me just add to that I've had a office in the Wilson Building for more than 15 years now, and I've never heard anybody say anything but good things about you, including that you're just a wonderfully nice guy. So
I really appreciate that. Thanks so much. Well, I'm delighted to be here.
And you know what? It's so true. You know, and that's really an accolade in D.C. politics to have nobody say something mean. You know, because I've heard something mean about everybody, but
it's
you.
An accolade in D.C. Period.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, to mitigate it, I have to say I've never run for any office, and so I've never had an adversary. Every one of my offices has been appointed, and so therefore, I haven't created, at least I hope not, any enemies.
But appointed world unto themselves.
Yeah, and
they have their own politics too, and it's not easy. So it's an amazing accolade.
And you know what? It just shows how smart you are that you've never run for an office. Can we start? Because this was a historic week in Washington, right? With the appointment of or the confirmation of Justice Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court as the first African American woman, and we know that you served along with her on a task force, and that she's been on the D.C. Appellate Court. So this is a lady you know. Tell us about her. What aren't they telling us about her that you would like to say?
Well, actually, I do know her very well. And in fact, I was asked by the American Bar Association to comment on her qualifications. And I gave her the highest grades possible. First of all, she is incredibly intelligent. The matter I worked with her on was for the Council for Court Excellence, which I have chaired in the past. And this was a project when she was a district court judge in the District of Columbia to improve the quality of jury service to make it more palatable for residents of the district to serve on juries because, you know, we don't have that great a population and people are repeatedly called to serve for jury service. And obviously some people are not happy with it, although it's a very important public service to serve on a jury. It's really part of our democracy. And she was just a fantastic co-leader of this enterprise. In addition to being a brilliant jurist, she is one of the nicest people that you ever want to meet. She is really everything you saw at the hearing, being patient and being kind and listening carefully and being very thoughtful in her responses. That's the way she is, and this is a fantastic appointment, and of course I was very disappointed that the Republicans in the Senate did not treat her with the respect that she has earned with her 2 degrees from Harvard and her judicial service and, of course, her prior service as a federal defender. I think she's going to be a wonderful addition to the Supreme Court. And I just wish she had gotten more votes from the Republican side.
Well, and by Supreme Court standards, she's a teenager, right? 50,
she's
51.
Young, 51. Brandeis was appointed to the Supreme Court when he was 60, and he served for 25 years after that. At 51, with a normal life expectancy, you could expect her to be on for almost 3 decades. So, right now she's not going to change the balance on the court. It's a 6-3 split in favor of the conservatives. But over the course of time and with proper election results, that could change. And so in the meantime, I think she'll be writing dissents in significant matters. But ultimately, I think she'll be able to persuade people to come to her side of the philosophy.
That's great. Marilia, do you have a question for our former Attorney General?
It's sort of along those lines. I have a lot of questions, but let me just ask, since we sort of touched a little bit upon the politics. What has happened to the Hatch Act? I saw that you had something to do with it in your brilliant career. It seems to me, I worked as a Schedule A, a political appointee, in two administrations, and we quaked in our shoes if we even approached something that seemed like a political event, because we had the fear of God put in us, that you do not violate the Hatch Act. Well, it seems with the Trump people that the Hatch Act doesn't even exist anymore. It just didn't stick, it seems. So what's happened to it?
Well, it's a very good point. Just so your listeners know, the Hatch Act means that civil servants, appointees in the government, are not supposed to engage in political and partisan activities. And for all the time that I was in government, in the executive branch at the Department of Justice, which was both in the Carter and Clinton administrations, we adhered strictly to the Hatch Act, and we did not engage in partisan political activities while in government service. And there is a special counsel who enforces the Hatch Act, and the Hatch Act even includes criminal penalties and civil penalties, and provides for some administrative restrictions that if there are violations. And during my time, there were some people who violated it and were sanctioned for it. During the Trump administration, it was ignored, and people just laughed at it, and there was wholesale violations of it, and I guess because the president appointed the person who was in charge of enforcing the Hatch Act, it simply wasn't enforced, and so there were partisan political activities by, for example, the president's daughter and son-in-law and the press head of the press office for the president, the press spokesman. And so I find it very, awful that it wasn't, first of all, adhered to, wasn't obeyed, and secondly, it wasn't enforced. But I think, you know, going forward in a administration that's committed to law and order, I think it it will be enforced in this administration and hopefully in coming administrations of both political parties.
Well, and you know, I worked on the Carter. The first thing I did out of college was work on the Carter campaign. And they put the fear of God, just like Marilia said, the fear of God in us about approaching people that were in the administration and, right. and what we could and could not ask them to do. Let me ask you, because I'm confused about this, and maybe you can give me some insight. I look to see what the final resolution of this has been, and it looks to me like we haven't resolved it yet. But for 28 years now, Delegate Norton has pushed for control of the National Guard by the mayor. They put a provision in the National Defense Budget Act that would give us control. It went to the Senate, but do you know what's happened? Has it passed, Irv? Does the mayor have control of the National Guard at this point?
I don't believe so, and I don't think that has happened. And that's an example of what I wrote about last week in the Washington Post. In my view, first of all, I'm in favor of statehood for the district, and I'm glad that you have a national audience, and people around the country should recognize that the district does not have statehood, which it should, and that means it doesn't have any senators, and it doesn't have voting representation in the Congress. But in 1973, before 1973, for 100 years, the district didn't even have a mayor or an elected city council. It had commissioners that were appointed by the president, and it basically had no self-rule. But in 1973, the district got limited home rule, and now it has an elected mayor and an elected city council, which it had also had in the early 19th century, but after the Civil War, lost that. But in the 1973 Act, which is called the Home Rule Act, which lays out what powers the city council and the mayor have, there are many limitations. It's a very restricted home rule. It's not complete home rule. And one of the limitations in the Home Rule Act is that the National Guard remains with the president in the district unless there is federal legislation. Everything can be changed. The Home Rule Act is a congressional act, and it can be modified by other congressional acts. So obviously there have been efforts to change the status of the National Guard and make it under the mayor as opposed to the president. And of course this issue became important on January 6th of this 2021 when it required the federal government to call out the local National Guard and not the mayor. So that should be changed. That's one of the many things that ought to be changed to give more power to the District of Columbia. And there have been efforts, as you mentioned, but I don't think that it has ever been consummated.
Not only the January 6th riot, where we've heard much testimony on behalf of people that the National Guard was called in late because of that restriction
that's one of the reasons
makes the federal.
President Trump didn't call him in. Ultimately, yeah. He actually had to be called by the vice president.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? If you look at what happened on January 6th, you can see that the tide was turned when the D.C. police, Metropolitan Police, were called in. So there's no doubt that the National Guard would have made a big difference, I think, if it had been under the control of the mayor. And also, you know, we had that other lovely incident where the president strolled out from the White House and, the guard was used to push peaceful protesters back in Lafayette Square. So, Again, if the mayor had been in control, it would have been a different issue altogether. Let me also ask you about judges in the District of Columbia. This is a big problem for us since we're talking about legal stuff here. But the Senate has drug its feet on confirming judges for the District of Columbia, so we have a serious lack of judges, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. The problem is that under the Home Rule Act and under the way judiciary is set up in the District of Columbia, the appointments of local judges in our Superior Court and in our Court of Appeals, the appointments are made by the president, and presidents, including President Trump, have made good appointments for the local courts. But the confirmation process is in the Senate. The Senate is required to advise and consent and ultimately confirm the same way as it does with federal judges. And the problem is that, obviously, there's nobody in the Senate who comes from the District of Columbia. So the senators who are interested in national problems and obviously problems in their states, they pay very little attention to the judiciary in the District of Columbia. And this is true basically whether it's Republicans or Democrats that are running the Judiciary Committee or the committee. It's the Government Operations Committee, which reviews the local judges. So there's been tremendous backlog in confirmation of judges who are appointed by the president because there's not a lot of attention paid. And this results in a poor system of justice for the residents of the District of Columbia, because when there are vacancies, and there have been, you know, dozens of vacancies in the Superior Court and several in the Court of Appeals, these vacancies last for a very long time. And what that means is that the judges who are on the bench have additional burdens. They have bigger caseloads. It takes more time to get cases to trial or to get resolved, and therefore justice is delayed, and as we know, that could result in denial of justice. So this is a very serious problem, and it's another example of where if there were true home rule for the District of Columbia, and the judges were appointed within the District of Columbia, say by the mayor, as is true in many states where the governor is appointed, and the confirmation could be in the city council rather than in the Senate, you would have equal quality of the judges, but a much more expeditious confirmation process, and therefore a full complement of judges in our courts, and therefore more justice, more expedited justice for our residents.
Let me point out that our limited home rule, Julius Hobson, former council member, used to call it home fool, because it really does limit what we're able to do. Marilia?
Well, I was going to ask, I was going to go on to the topic of corruption, if you don't mind. We've come a long way in D.C., but I know, and everybody knows, I suppose, that we still have corruption, and it corrodes government and democracy, and I think it hurts our chances of statehood as well. As former Attorney General and your incredibly diverse career in D.C., which is pretty amazing, you've run the gamut of everything. I don't know if there's anything else you could do. But you've got a great bird's eye view of, let's say, the politics and the law behind politics. And so my question to you is, how can we do better at preventing corruption? How do we shine a spotlight from within government and sort of beyond the vigilance of the media?
Well, let me say, first of all, corruption is not by any means limited to the District of Columbia. You know, when I was at the Department of Justice, and I handled the abscam prosecutions, which were bribery cases made against members of Congress who came from multiple states and from the Senate. And, of course, I come from Maryland, and I was in the courtroom, actually, when Spiro Agnew pled nolo. He had been the governor of Maryland and then vice president, and was taking payments. And we've had governors in other states, in Illinois and elsewhere, and we have now in the Michigan legislature. So, you know, corruption is a problem throughout the country, maybe throughout the world. So I wouldn't limit it to the District of Columbia. But within the District of Columbia, I think, you know, when I was the Attorney General, I pursued a case against a city councilman. It was the first time that an Attorney General has pursued a city councilman. This was Harry Thomas Jr., who had taken funds that were intended for amateur sports in the District of Columbia and used it for his own personal expenses. It was quite inappropriate, and it led to we brought a civil case to seek a return of the money and laid out all of what had happened, but it was the U.S. Attorney's Office that handled the criminal prosecution, because that's the way that the Congress has divided up responsibility, which is that the U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia handles all felony prosecutions, including of local crimes that the D.C. City Council creates the crimes, or you know, as well as the Congress. But the D.C. Council has authority to create crimes, but the prosecution of felonies, of all felonies in the District of Columbia, are done by the federal government. And so, obviously, the federal government handles corruption prosecutions. Which is true, by the way, in other situations as well, where federal crimes are involved. But the difference here is that local crimes are prosecuted by the federal U.S. attorney, as opposed to the elected attorney general of the District of Columbia. I was not elected. I was the last appointed attorney general. Mm-hmm. But the current attorney general, Carl Racine, and now we have an election coming up this year for the new elected attorney general, because Carl Racine is not running again. One way to improve the concern about corruption in the district is to give local authority to the locally elected prosecutors or attorneys general to the right to pursue criminal allegations, corruption allegations against local office holders. But at the same time, I think there's much that can be done. There is a board that deals with government regulations. That's the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. There are inspectors general in various agencies that can look for corruption. Obviously, the press is an important thing, a shining light on problems that exist. So I think corruption is a serious problem. I think it's a problem in many jurisdictions across the country. I think vigilance by the populace and by inspectors general, by the press, and of course by the prosecutors and the investigative agencies is all a way to handle it, to bring it to light, to prosecute it to the full extent of the law, and to eliminate it from our politics.
Just seems like it's been eroded under Trump, like all these institutions that you named, all these things, IGs, everything that is in place to do that. I get the sense that it has been eroded and that people don't even expect any vigilance to take place, much less prosecution.
Well, I think with the new administration and with Merrick Garland in at the mm-hmm. Department of Justice as the Attorney General, who was committed to a rule of law and pursuit of these kinds of matters, I agree with you that over the 4 years that Trump was there, there was a diminution. I mean, he fired several inspectors general after they came out with negative reports about him or his appointees, and that's, you know, very unfortunate. That's contrary to the whole process of inspectors general. They're supposed to be independent, mm-hmm. and they're supposed to be able to call attention to problems and to refer matters for prosecution. and obviously they shouldn't be fired for doing their jobs. And yes, there was an undermining of it during those years, but I think there's a restoration in place, and I think we can be confident going forward, at least for the duration of the Biden administration.
Yeah, it's good to know.
Well, let me say, as a former resident of Newark, New Jersey, yeah, there's corruption in other places besides Washington, D.C. I would also like to give a shout out to the voters of the District of Columbia, because the man you prosecuted, Harry Thomas, for stealing money from the Little League, just tried to run for city council and couldn't raise enough money to run. So then he was going to run to be part of our delegation, and he couldn't get enough signatures to get on the ballot. So at least the voters are paying attention, because I believe in repentance, but you shouldn't just be able to sit out for a term or two and then run again. But since you mentioned that you were the last appointed attorney general, Sharon from Pennsylvania just Skyped in a question. Why didn't you run to be the first elected attorney general?
Well, to be candid, I don't think I'm an attractive public official. I don't really make great stump speeches and things like that. And I had served, 4 years, and it was a very heavy load to deal with it. I did recruit someone that I thought was appropriate for the elected attorney general position, and that was Carl Racine. And I think my judgment has been vindicated. He's served for two terms, and I think he's done an excellent job. So it just wasn't my specialty to be running for election, and so I declined to take that opportunity.
Well, I hate to disagree with you, but I think you'd make a great candidate, and I think you were right about Carl Racine, and he really has pushed the envelope.
He's done a very good job.
I know that most recently he's, besides filing an emoluments suit against the president, which really didn't go anywhere, for our listeners, there's a clause of the Constitution that says you can't benefit from your public office, and Carl went after the president for doing exactly that. He's included some people from the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys in the January 6th uprising. He's suing them. And he's also got a suit that Marilli and I don't think we understand, right, where he's suing Grubhub. I'm not sure that we get that one, but he really has pushed the envelope.
Yeah. On the emoluments case, and it says that you can't take emoluments from, you can't take additional profits from foreign governments and others when you're the president. He did get a very good decision from Judge Massetti in the district court in Maryland. He brought that with Brian Frosch, the excellent attorney general in Maryland, who also now has retired or is not running again for reelection. And so they got a very good decision in the district court. It then got set aside with a conservative panel in the Fourth Circuit. But it was remanded to the district court, and that decision is still on the books, the one that Judge Massetti wrote, and defining emoluments as taking these kinds of payments at the hotel that Trump owned from foreign dignitaries that went into, basically the profits went into his pockets. So I think he did establish a good precedent there, even though they didn't get a good result in this particular case. But it was a good effort on their part and worthwhile to do.
And I would also point out, whereas you were appointed by the mayor, Carl and our current mayor don't seem to be on the same page. He's actually endorsed another candidate in the upcoming election, and he certainly has been at odds with the mayor at points. So,
yeah, I think that's unfortunate. And, of course, that's the result of a perception, probably by the mayor, that the attorney general would be a candidate for mayor and that they could be political rivals somewhere down the line. I think that's unfortunate, and I think it would be helpful if the candidate for attorney general is not perceived as a candidate to be mayor at some future election, and therefore the mayor and the attorney general, the elected attorney general, can work together for the best interests of the district. Certainly, that was a situation that I had as an appointed. It was in a unique situation when I was appointed because it was as an interim before the election, and what the statute said was that the mayor would appoint the attorney general and subject to confirmation by the city council, and then once confirmed, the attorney general could not be fired unless there was good cause shown, which meant that if I didn't screw up and give any justification for it, I was completely independent as the attorney general. But having been appointed by the mayor and being part of his administration, I attended all the mayor's senior staff meetings. I knew where the mayor wanted to take the city. This is Vincent Gray, who was really devoted to the best interests of the district. And we could work cooperatively, although I had, you know, my independence. If they were going to do something that was not within the legal bounds, I would let them know about that. And in fact, for example, on the Harry Thomas that we mentioned, Harry Thomas was a political ally of Vince Gray, and I pursued that case. I gave advance notice to the mayor, and he was fully supportive. But I knew that it wasn't going to be good for the mayor, but it was good for the city. And we had no doubt that the attorney general represents the city of the District of Columbia, the entity of the city, and the city government doesn't represent the mayor or any particular individual. And so we were good on that, but we worked very cooperatively together. And I think an elected attorney general who is not perceived as a potential candidate for mayor can, again, work very closely with the mayor and do the best for the city.
Well, and, you know, we have the Washington Post maybe to thank for that animosity between the two of them, because they push the idea that Carl Racine should run for mayor.
Well, Which he never did. I agree that it was a perception, and that perception was unfortunate.
Yeah. Go ahead, Marilia. Do you have another question? I don't want to monopolize the Attorney General's time.
Quite all right. I think we already have. really
my
appreciate.
Pleasure.
Yeah, it's very kind. Appreciate your taking your Sunday night and spending it on the show. I wanted to ask you for your views on the prison system in D.C. I know there's problems with it and they haven't been addressed. And I know that prison reform is an order. It's an order across the country because, as you know, we have the highest prison percentage of blacks in the prison population, and we have the highest prison population, I think, worldwide, proportionally speaking. And there is no reform. There is no rehab. It's just harsh prison life, and it doesn't produce anything but recidivism. Do you have a view on or what can be implemented or why it hasn't anything
yes.
been? And what can be, you know, in terms of the Norwegian sort of approach to prison?
Yeah, I do. And in that connection, as I mentioned, the Council for Court Excellence, which I'm a member now of the executive committee, I had previously been the chair of the organization. It's an organization that's dedicated to improving justice in the District of Columbia. It's made up of practitioners, both prosecutors and defense lawyers, criminal defense lawyers, civil plaintiffs lawyers and defense lawyers, judges and lay people, and people from corporations in the city. And it has formed a task force to look at the prison system and has issued a couple of reports which have talked about improving, setting up, creating a new jail for the District of Columbia, minimizing the number of people who are incarcerated or who are incarcerated for long periods of time, focusing more on rehabilitation and putting people back in the community, returning citizens, getting housing for those people, getting employment for those people, having their civil rights restored, and basically reducing the number of people who are in our jails or in our prisons, and working with them to educate them and rehabilitate them and set them on a right path. And one of the things that this task force would do is to reduce the number of offenses that require jail time, to do more fines or community service, and basically reduce the number of prisoners and reduce the time that people serve in prison, and obviously improve the rehabilitation process. You know, right now, this is another situation that we have a very difficult situation in the District of Columbia, because people in the District of Columbia who are convicted of D.C. crimes, that is, crimes that are in the D.C. Code, that are local felonies in the District of Columbia, are tried in the local courts, but when they're convicted, they are sent to federal prisons, and they can be sent to federal prisons throughout the country. So if they're sent to California, Colorado, or other places, they're away from their families, they're away from their friends, they can't be visited, they can't communicate, and they don't get the kinds of services that the District of Columbia government prescribes for people who are going to return to the district at some point. So they don't get the kind of skills, employment skills, and then training. So that's another problem that we have, and I think we need to focus on improving that system and making sure that people who have to be incarcerated for local crimes are, and if they need to be incarcerated, that are incarcerated in a facility that's in the district or close to the district, where they can be close to family and friends and pastors from their churches, and can get the kind of services that the district would like to give to those people, so as returning citizens, they can stay on the straight and narrow.
Amen.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so important. And, you know, it really is the difference between trying to rehabilitate people and just housing them. It's really obscene that we send our people to Texas
and, you know, and California. And you saw this in the confirmation hearing that you started with, you know, that the notion that people just want you know, very long prison sentences. For example, the case that Ketanji Brown Jackson was criticized for by some Republicans like Hawley and Cruz, it was a 17-year-old boy who, you know, was in possession of materials that he shouldn't have been in possession of, and it is a crime, but the notion that you want to throw the book at him and have him serve a long time, serve with hardened criminals for a long period of time, get no services, no rehabilitation, and then bring them back to the community, it makes no sense. It serves a political purpose. They can bang the table and say we should throw the book at these guys and throw them away. And that's not the way to deal with a human being. And the judge recognized that. She gave him 3 months in jail to recognize the seriousness of it. She put him on probation following that so that he could have a life. 17 is just much too young to be rejected by society and thrown away.
Well, you know, I think that unfortunately in some of the confirmation hearings, we've seen the racism that's still, you know, inherent in the system. I don't know, Irv, if you've seen this rant that the senator from it escapes me now, but Lindsey Graham from South Carolina has done this horrible commercial, you know, already about how you know, he wasn't in favor of her, and he's implied that she got the job based on her race instead of on her qualifications. It's just it's awful. So let me ask you.
We still do have racism that's a part of our system. There's no question about it, and we need to be vigilant to work against it.
Well, and let me ask you, as someone who spent so much time as counsel to Congress, including the Judiciary Committee, have you ever seen a situation like we have today where there's so much partisanship and where we're so separated? It seems to me that there's a lack of consciousness of conscience in Congress. Now it's all about getting reelected, and that's it. Do you think that?
I think it has deteriorated the confirmation process. I make it clear. I worked in the House. I never served in the with the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I was on that staff. I was involved with the Senate Intelligence Committee, but I was general counsel of the House, But I've observed, obviously, the confirmation process in the Senate Judiciary Committee over the years, and it has clearly deteriorated. You know that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was a very liberal justice, was overwhelmingly confirmed. Even Judge Stephen Breyer, whose seat Judge Jackson will be taking, he was an aide to Senator Kennedy. He was a very liberal. Professor from Harvard, he received overwhelming support. Now the Republicans, I mean, what they did with Merrick Garland is a disgrace. Not even giving him a hearing, and Garland is a very moderate and middle of the road judge, and eminently qualified for the Supreme Court. And when McConnell was the majority leader, they wouldn't give him a hearing. They now are saying that. If they take the Senate and Biden has another appointment, even if it's not in the last year of his administration, they won't give a hearing to a Biden nominee. This is outrageous, and it's against it's contrary to the Constitution, it's contrary to our traditions and our history, and it's contrary to our best interests. There needs to be a real overhaul here of the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Republicans in the Senate, to recognize their responsibility to give a fair hearing to any qualified candidate that the president appoints. That's the way it has been during my lifetime and before, but it has not been over the last several years.
Well, I don't want to digress here, but I have to make a confession. I hope you don't think less of me for this, Marilia, but the first political candidate I ever worked for was Spiro Agnew. I was 12 years old. I moved to Washington, D.C. I was 12 years old, and a neighbor who was a Republican committee person slapped a skimmer on my head and her son, who was my best friend, Joey, and she took us to the polls to hand out literature for him. A sin that I've tried to repent for.
What was he running for when you were working?
He was running for governor of Maryland. Yeah. Yeah,
so you worked in Maryland, because if you were in the district, you didn't have the opportunity to work for any elected official in the district.
Right. when we moved to D.C., we moved to Montgomery County.
So you were in Maryland.
I was in Maryland until I got out of high school, right. And which was too long ago to remember, actually. Well, let me tell you, I've got one last thing that I've got to talk to you about. Mr. Attorney General, I read your op-ed in last Sunday's paper, and right. The thing that worries me about it, I wonder why you think, since we've tried budget autonomy, we've tried legal autonomy, most recently D.C. Appleseed brought a suit with other people, Castanon et al. Against you, the U.S. for representation. We keep on losing in the court. No, the Congress doesn't seem to want to budge on any issue on the National Guard or anything else. And, you know, the first guy I worked for, or was when I worked for the Carter reelection, was Bob Strauss, who has a law firm here in Washington. Right. Mr. Strauss is no longer with us, but I went to the law firm and they advised me that it was made very, very clear in Adams v. Clinton that our struggle is not a legal struggle, it's a political battle. So it seems that we have no standing in court and that the Republicans in Congress hate us. In fact, as you mentioned in the article, two United States representatives want to get rid of home rule. So what is it that makes you think that it would be a better path to go after these changes than to go for statehood? Because what really bothers me about that argument is that I think it's a diversion. I think we've got one foot on the platform, one foot on the train. What do you think about it?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm a big supporter of statehood for the district. I think that the district deserves statehood. It should have that right. People need to recognize that, you know, the people who are in the jurisdictions that make up the district is made up of land that was first in Maryland and then in Virginia, and they brought it together to make the District of Columbia. And so before the District of Columbia was created, which was at the beginning of the 19th century, those people all had representation in Congress, and they voted for senators or they voted for the House of Representatives, and the Senate at that time was elected by the state legislatures. But since that time, obviously, we don't have a vote here, a voice in the Congress. We don't have two elected senators, and we don't even have a voting representative. And if we were a state, we'd have two senators and a voting member of Congress. And that clearly is the ideal, and I'm in favor of that taking place. But the political reality, so long as there's a filibuster and the ability of the Republicans to block that in the Senate, to block it, that's not going to happen because they recognize that a overwhelming majority of the residents in the District of Columbia are vote Democratic, and there would likely be two Democratic senators, and that means that, especially as it's really close, it's 50-50 now, and it's going to be close after the next election, one way or the other. So two more Democrats would really alter the balance, and the Republicans are not fools, and they recognize that. So they're not going to be supportive of statehood. So without giving up on statehood, the question is what you can do in the meantime before statehood becomes a reality. And that doesn't mean taking away from the efforts to get statehood, but in the meantime, the home rule is very limited. And as I mentioned in the article, you know, a couple of things that you can't do under our home rule. First of all, the city council does not have control over the budget. The budget, even of all the taxes and revenues that are raised by the District of Columbia, where the city council passes the legislation that says what the taxes will be and collects the taxes, those monies can't be spent without an appropriation from Congress, because that's what the Home Rule Act says. I mean, there's some division in the courts about this, and there's some confusion, but that's basically what the statute says. It also says, for example, as I point out, that the city council can't change the powers of the U.S. attorney, which is a federal appointed office. It's not controlled by the district, and there's no reason that the person who is the U.S. attorney in the district has to be terribly concerned about the citizens of the district, because he or she is appointed by the federal government, the president, appointed and confirmed by the Senate. So it doesn't seem to me that there's a good reason why the city council can't make legislation that gives more authority to the attorney general and takes it away from the U.S. attorney. That could be done so long as the Home Rule Act were changed. And my view is that, and when you say that, you know, there's no interest, the fact is that the Democratic-controlled House has passed a bill for statehood, but it is stalled in the Senate, and it's not likely to get further in the Senate. So, you know, there is interest in the Democratic Party. It's in the platform of the Democratic Party, and the president has supported it, of statehood, but it's clearly not going to happen anytime soon. And while it's not happening, there can be efforts to improve the amount of self-determination that the district has and the control over its own destiny and the policies it sets, if it had more authority under the Limited Home Rule Act that was passed as part of a compromise back in 1973. We've had, you know, over 50 years since, or about 50 years since 1973, of the functioning of the District of Columbia government. And for the most part, and certainly over the last couple of decades, the district has done extremely well and has demonstrated it has a ability to govern itself and to make policies that are sensible. So if I were within the District of Columbia government, I would be urging Congress, give us statehood, but if you can't give us statehood, give us more power under the Home Rule Act so we can get the next stage, get to, as happened, for example, with the elected attorney general. That was another stage towards more determination by the citizens of the district. And there are more things that can be done in the Home Rule Act to give more power to the mayor and the city council so that the people in the District of Columbia, like people in all the states in the United States, are governing themselves and have fuller democracy.
Well, again, my only problem, you know, I remember the D.C. Voting Rights Act, which we spent millions of dollars and years working on, passed both houses of Congress, but never became law. For our listeners who might not know what that is, it was a great idea that came up with by a Republican congressman from Virginia named Tom Davis, that we give one vote to Utah and one vote to the District of Columbia. And, you know, we don't have voting representation in the House, but we have this fierce advocate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's our delegate. And giving her a vote wouldn't have been given up very much. And the Republicans weren't even willing to do that. I mean, you're absolutely right. The thing that keeps us from making this happen is two Democrats in the Senate. They absolutely don't want that. But we'll have to agree to disagree a little bit there, Mr. Attorney General. But yeah, I understand your sentiment. Marilia, we're almost out of time. Do you want to ask the last question? Marilia, have we lost you? We may have lost her.
Here I am.
Okay. Do you want to ask the last question?
Yes. I just wanted to ask a quick question about Davis-Bacon, and I'm sure that you will enlighten the audience as to exactly what Davis-Bacon is. My confusion is, I see that you were involved in a Davis-Bacon case involving City Center. I thought Davis-Bacon applied only to federal contracts, and it is something I have a problem with because I think it just increases the budget outlay of the federal government, because the last time I knew about Davis-Bacon in detail was that you have to pay, I think it's 1.5 times the wages to union workers when they work on construction of relating to federal contracts. Am I right?
Well, I'm a little rusty on my Davis-Bacon recollections, but basically, if it's a federal project, it has to be the workers have to be paid at union levels, at the wages that the union has negotiated. And if it's not a federal contract, then it doesn't have to have union wages. And with respect to the City Center, the question was whether this was a federal project, and we got a ruling that it was not, and that the city did not have to pay those union wages, which would have elevated the costs very significantly. So we went to court, and we were successful in saving funds for the district.
That was exactly question as to whether or not that applied, the federal applied to City Center. So thank you, and thank you for defending that well.
Right.
Well, we're out of time. And thank you so much, Mr. Attorney General, for being with us. I wanna go on record is if you ever change your mind about running for elected office, I volunteer to be your campaign manager. I'm not particularly good, but I work for free, which is a big benefit.
Well, the rate and, sounds good to me.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. Thank you guys very much.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
You know, it's amazing what they'll let you do if you're willing to do it for free,
you can be
a United States senator. But anyway, we usually leave with a song dedicated to our guests. Since this is such a historic week with Ketanji Jay, I have such a hard time with her first name.
Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Ketanji Brown Jackson being nominated. This goes out to two great public servants, Judge Brown Jackson and former Attorney General Irv Nathan. Here's Mahalia Jackson with We Shall Overcome.
Well, that's great. Thanks.
Thank you.
See you next week.
We shall overcome one day. Give the people their right to vote.